from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. This is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, it's the world's biggest sport, so why hasn't there been a truly great movie about soccer? Then playwright Roberto Aguirre-Sacasa attended the same school as Brett Kavanaugh. He reworked his play Good Boys about prep school culture and sexual assault after the Kavanaugh hearings.
I recognized it immediately. Now, I had a lot of great memories from my time at prep, but the culture that Kavanaugh came from, yeah, I saw some of that for sure.
And the LA company Rogue Machine Theater tackles racism and gun violence on stage. All that coming up on The Frame. The 4th of July weekend is usually a big one at the box office, and there's a new Spider-Man movie that will probably bring in a ton of money.
You're a very difficult person to contact, Spider-Man.
But Peter Parker battling against Mysterio is not the holiday weekend's most important showdown. Instead...
Go! Happy birthday, Alex Morgan!
It's the American women's soccer team in the finals of the Women's World Cup in France. They will play for the championship on Sunday. The tournament has been a ratings blockbuster. By the time the final whistle blows on Sunday, I'm predicting a U.S. win, 2-0. As many as 1 billion people around the globe will have tuned into the World Cup. But as popular as soccer is as a televised sport, it's really hard to think of a great soccer movie. And people will say, what about 2002's Bennett Like Beckham?
That was brilliant. Do you play for any side?
Think I'm good enough?
Yeah.
Watched you a couple of times. You've gotten really good.
But Bennett Like Beckham is really a coming-of-age tale about rebellion, and the soccer scenes aren't much better than what you could see on the sidelines of an AYSO game. 10 years ago, Gael Garcia Bernal and Diego Luna starred in Rudo y Cursi. But that Spanish-language soccer movie received mixed reviews, and it didn't even gross $2 million at the box office. Yet, almost every other sport has at least one movie, if not several, that have been critical and commercial hits. Long-distance runners have Chariots of Fire, boxing has Creed, Raging Bull, Rocky, and Million Dollar Baby. And those last two movies, Rocky and Million Dollar Baby, like Chariots of Fire, won the Best Picture Oscar. Baseball has The Natural, 8 Men Out, and 2 classic Kevin Costner movies, Bull Durham and Field of Dreams. Women in sports are notoriously ignored. Imagine that happening in Hollywood. But there are a couple of exceptions, like A League of Their Own, about an all-female baseball team.
Are you crying?
No.
Are you crying? Oh. Are you crying? There's no crying. There's no crying in baseball.
Why don't you leave her alone, Jimmy?
Oh, you zip it, Doris.
Football has North Dallas 40, Remember the Titans, The Blind Side. Hockey has Miracle and Slapshot. Basketball has Hoosiers. Golf has Tin Cup and Caddyshack.
This is a hybrid. This is a cross, bluegrass, Kentucky bluegrass, featherbed bench, and Northern California Sensimilla. The amazing stuff about this is that you can play 36 holes on it in the afternoon. Take it home and just get stoned in a bejesus belt.
Come on. It's a great movie. For horse racing fans, there's Seabiscuit. For billiards, there's The Color of Money. But when soccer's the game, Hollywood typically reduces the world's most popular sport to lowbrow comedies like Air Bud, World Pup.
I don't believe it. The U.S. has designated Buddy Fram to replace Scurry.
Frank, you're kidding. A dog?
Or slightly less stupid movies that are soccer versions of baseball's Bad News Bears, with comedians like Will Ferrell playing hapless coaches with hapless soccer teams. Here's Ferrell in Kicking and Screaming.
Okay, guys, I only want winners out on the field. Who's a winner? I said, who's a winner? Everyone's hand should be up.
I am.
Okay, everyone bring it in. All right, let's break someone's clavicle on three. 1, 2, 3, break someone's clavicle! Hit the field, let's go.
There was Victory, a 1981 movie from director John Huston that featured the pro soccer star Pele playing against the Nazis.
I want to play.
You can't play like that.
I feel good. I feel better. I must play.
Ref, he's coming back on.
But soccer was not the point of the movie. It was a POW escape drama. And Sylvester Stallone was the goalie, which pretty much says all you need to know.
Am I good? Or am I good?
What's your name?
You know my name.
Even when Hollywood starts with a good idea for a soccer movie, it misses the net. When 20th Century Fox turned Nick Hornby's fantastic soccer book Fever Pitch into a movie, the sport was changed from soccer to baseball.
You know, now she expects me to miss a Yankees game?
All right, Mr. Reitman, I got a bat. Let me just leave you with this thought. You love the Sox, but have they ever loved you back?
Now, granted, there are several challenges in making a great soccer movie. One thing, the country has been slow to embrace the sport, so maybe people in Hollywood are worried there's not an audience for a soccer movie, to which I would say, what about the dodgeball movie? People watch that.
If you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball.
What?
Oh. And even though soccer has some great individual players, it's still a team sport. Unlike football and baseball, there are no regular breaks where the audience can learn something about the athletes in the middle of the game. It's also really hard to capture on the big screen the artistry of what makes someone like Alex Morgan or Tobin Heath or Carly Lloyd so good. Their fakes and accelerations can happen in the blink of an eye. Can you make a movie by focusing on someone's feet? So maybe the best soccer story continues to be not what you might be able to see in some movie theater, but what you can watch right now on television. In other words, the real thing.
Low one and all the way in! A dream start for the United States!
Coming up on The Frame, how the creator of the CW series Riverdale was inspired to rewrite one of his plays after Brett Kavanaugh's Supreme Court hearings. Roberto Aguirre-Sacasa has a lot of experience with reinvention and adolescence, whether it's with classic comic strip characters as chief creative officer at Archie Comics or as the showrunner of TV shows like Riverdale on the CW network and The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina on Netflix. Now, Aguirre-Sacasa has reworked his own script, informed by his experiences in prep school, in the play Good Boys. It's now at the Pasadena Playhouse.
It unpacked themes of privilege and sexuality and toxic masculinity. And when I heard that the Pasadena Playhouse was looking for a play to produce, I sent Danny, the artistic director, a copy of the script, and he read it and he said, "Did you just write this?" And I said, no, I wrote this, 15 years ago.
The striking timeliness Aguirre-Sacasa is talking about is the original play's similarities to the testimony of Christine Blasey Ford. Ford accused then Supreme Court Justice nominee Brett Kavanaugh of sexual assault when they were in high school. As it turns out, Aguirre-Sacasa went to Georgetown Prep, the very same D.C. area prep school that Kavanaugh attended, although not at the same time. When Aguirre-Sacasa visited our studios, I played a clip from the Kavanaugh hearings that inspired him to take a fresh look at his play, Good Boys.
When I was in town, I spent much of my time working out, lifting weights, playing basketball, or hanging out and having some beers with friends as we talked about life and football and school and girls.
I want you to think about what it was like watching those hearings and what you started thinking about your own prep school and about this play.
It was really interesting. You know, the writer's room offices of Riverdale and Sabrina are in the CNN building. So you walk in the lobby, there's a million screens playing the news. You get on an elevator, there's a million screens playing the news. And I remember vividly when the story broke that an accuser had stepped forward and accused Kavanaugh of sexual assault. I just read the headline and I immediately thought, I bet this is about when he was at Georgetown Prep. And so then I went upstairs and I, got online and read, and I saw that it was a woman who Brett knew in high school who had accused him of sexual assault. And I immediately thought of my play Good Boys. And there's one scene in the play in the second act where the accused and his victim, the girl, give testimony. and the hair on the back of my neck stood up. We all gathered and watched the hearings and couldn't believe what we were seeing. And it was mind-blowing.
And even if you don't have an opinion one way or the other about Brett Kavanaugh or Christine Blasey Ford about who was telling the truth, do you believe that that kind of behavior happened in that era and when you were at Georgetown Prep?
Yeah, it's a really good question. You know, my dad went to Georgetown Prep. I think he graduated in the 60s. And, you know, I called my dad and I said, Dad, what do you think of all this? And my dad said, well, there was none of that when I was there. And he said, was that your experience? And I said, what is being described about Kavanaugh, I recognized it immediately. Now, I had a lot of great memories from my time at Prep, but the culture that Kavanaugh came from, yeah, I saw some of that for sure.
I want to ask you about a couple of scenes. The context is there is a sex tape. This is 1989, so it's pre-social media, but there's a video cassette of a sex tape, and there's a question about who is in it and whether or not the woman who is sexually assaulted in it is going to become a factor in the story. And there are two boys that are talking about the tape and about the woman who's in it. And one of them is named Brandon. The other one is named Justin. And Justin says, so your plan is chilling in its simplicity and brilliance, except that, you know, the girl on the tape is out there. And Brandon says, she's not going to say anything.
When he says that line, he thinks, what could she possibly gain by coming forward? She's going to be embarrassed. I'm not going to be embarrassed. No one at the school where I go to cares about anything like that. You know, not only that, many of my friends do similar things like that. So the only person who's going to get in trouble or will be stained by this is the girl. That's his thinking, which of course is deeply, deeply disturbing and wrongheaded.
And that gets to kind of a bigger theme in the play, which is about entitlement and privilege and responsibility. The mother, Elizabeth Hardy, realizes that she might be part of the story in what she has allowed her son to believe about himself and the way that they operate separate from others. And that there are a lot of people who are having epiphanies in the course of this play. But I think Elizabeth Hardy, the boy's mom, is maybe having the most profound one about how the actions of her as a parent are coming back in some ways to haunt her.
Yeah, that I would say is one of the biggest revisions to the play over the last, you know, 15 years. Kind of the center of the play shifted a little bit from Brandon the boy onto Elizabeth, his mother. And I was really, really interested in Elizabeth's journey in which she has to recognize her own complicity in raising Brandon to be the kind of young man who would do something like this. Moreover, she's forced to examine actions she's done in the present and actions she's done in the past while she was a student at an all-girls prep school that are not too dissimilar from what Brandon did. And I think the blinders come off her in this play.
I'm going to ask you about another scene late in the play between the mother and another woman. I'm not going to say who the woman is because it's a little bit of a spoiler, but they're having a conversation about like moving on and next steps. The other woman says, you're over there, Mrs. Hardy, on that side of the table, and I'm over here on this side, and it's going to take me a while to get over there. I'm going to do it. I'm doing it. But it's not going to be super easy.
In a very direct way, the play is about privilege and class. And Brandon and his mother live on one tier. They're very well off. And Brandon takes advantage of a girl who goes to a public school, who lives on the wrong side of the tracks, who only has a single parent, who splits the rent with her mom. And she both is attracted by what Brandon represents and ultimately repulsed by it. That scene to me gets to the heart of the question about privilege and class that the play is examining.
We're talking with Roberto Aguirre-Sacasa about his play, Good Boys. Beyond being a playwright, you're a TV producer and writer and have worked in feature films as well. And you seem to have a very passionate interest in the darker side of adolescence.
Yeah.
it could be your film Carrie, could be part of your comics in Archie, Riverdale, Chilling Adventures of Sabrina on television. And I'm wondering, what is it about coming-of-age stories that you think gives you an opportunity to tell parables or share life lessons? What's behind it?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. A lot of the stuff I work on does have young people and is set during the you know, the coming of age. It's an inherently dramatic time in a person's life.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. It is both. On one level, yes, it's about zombies, but it's also about the Cold War.
Civil rights.
The collapse of the nuclear family.
Everything is life or death. You love and hate passionately. As for being drawn to the darker side of coming of age stories, you know, I kind of feel like I'm an optimistic guy and I'm an optimistic writer. So for instance, in Good Boys, even though terrible things happen in this play and terrible things are revealed about certain characters in this play, I hope that their story is just beginning and that they find some way to understand what they did to each other and what they allowed themselves to do to other people. So even that play, even the play as dark as it is, and it does get dark, I believe there's a strain of optimism. And I think that's kind of true in Riverdale and Sabrina as well.
And if you look at Archie over the last couple of decades, Archie begins as a comic book character where everybody's happy, everybody's straight, everybody's white, everybody gets along. And if you fast forward to Archie under your guidance.
Game changer. Archie got hot. He's got abs now.
People are gay and straight. People are not always happy. People have different skin color. And is that a reflection of the world? Is it a reflection of you? And why is it important that things evolve the way they do?
Yeah, the head of Archie Comics is a gentleman named John Goldwater, a very good friend. And when he took over the family business, it was his family's business, he really wanted to blow the cobwebs off Archie. So he's the one that kind of started truly the Archie Renaissance. He and I started working together, and we actually first were trying to get Archie done as a movie. We went to every studio, and every studio turned us down because they said, oh, that's not edgy enough. That brand means nothing to no one. We started taking it around as a television series. And as that television series evolved and developed, I said, it's a coming of age show. And people said, you have to put your stamp on it. You know, for instance, Glee was a coming of age show, but that was a musical.
Right.
And I am drawn to crime and horror and noir and pulp.
Our story is about a town, a small town, and the people who live in the town. From a distance, it presents itself like so many other small towns all over the world. Safe, decent, innocent. Get closer, though, and you start seeing the shadows underneath. The name of our town is Riverdale.
So when my kind of boss, Greg Berlanti, said to me, you know, you should think about there being a dead body in Riverdale. I don't know if he said it tongue-in-cheek or he said it genuinely, but my first thought was, there can't be a dead body in Riverdale. And then sort of a day or two later, I started thinking about coming-of-age movies like Stand By Me. And I thought, oh, you know what? There might be a different way to tell this story that is a little bit darker and is less a coming-of-age story, but a loss-of-innocence story. And that's what really crystallized Riverdale. And that show exists in the tension between the wholesome 1950s utopia that exists in the old Archie comics and the darker, more David Lynch-like tones of a small town like Twin Peaks.
Good Boys is a play, and it really feels like it could be a TV movie or a feature film. Could it be?
Yeah, on and off, people have optioned it and talked about turning it into a movie because it does have an element of suspense and an element of mystery. I'd love to see that done. You know, I now have a little more clout because of the shows, so I do have dreams of turning it into a movie, yes.
Roberto Aguirre-Sacasa is the playwright of Good Boys. It's at the Pasadena Playhouse now through July 21st. Roberto, thanks so much for coming.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up on The Frame, a remounted production of another play, this one about racism and gun violence in America. A group of artists concerned about racism and gun violence in America has banded together to explore those and other tough topics. The LA company Rogue Machine Theater hopes that storytelling on a stage can ease some of the fear and frustration involved in the fight against systemic racism. The Frame contributor Marcos Najera has the story on the company's play, Gunshot Medley, Part 1.
The Collaborative Artist Block is a collective of writers, actors, and designers, many from the Rogue Machine Company, who want to mount new work that explores social justice issues and cultural identity in underserved communities. Working together, the Collaborative Artist Block and Rogue Machine have set up shop to present this show called Gunshot Medley, Part 1. These artists say while there is a rich history of visual art in South LA, they want to help boost access to the performing arts.
We are in a special time in history.
Here's show director Deshaun Terry.
One of the things we have to do is that we have to look to the past.
To the center, you know what type I'm talking about.
By us remembering, you know, all these things and seeing what the past has done.
Well, just keep it down. I don't want to hear George mouth today. You want to make him mad again?
I ain't scared.
I think we need to be louder. I think that specifically as artists, socially and politically, and I hope that other artists, you know, listen to the call.
That's exactly what Terry did. He literally put out a call to artists on Facebook. In an online post that was a want ad of sorts, Terry said he was looking for a playwright who'd be willing to pen a script about race relations and firearms.
Black is the color of my true love's hair.
Deanna Michelle Daniel answered his call.
Yeah, so I was in my hometown of Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and I was walking in the cemetery with my mentor, Nathan Ross Freeman.
His face, so soft and wondrous fair.
We were walking and we saw that somebody had placed little Confederate flags on the graves of Confederate soldiers. And because of that, I was flustered, I was angry, and my mentor said, hey, let me, have you seen the slave graves? And I was like, no.
The purest eyes.
And I've been to the cemetery in North Carolina many times before and never knew that slaves were buried there. And so we like literally hopped over some bushes and they were hidden from the rest of the cemetery. And I found these three stones, Betty, Alvis, and George.
And the strongest.
Daniel says her anger about gun violence, coupled with the national debate over Confederate flags and statues, fueled her fire to write the stories of those three forgotten slaves. She describes it as a Black Lives Matter story from slavery to now.
Well, that's what I was about to explain to you.
You know what you should have been out there doing?
What this time, Betty? What should I have been doing?
Keeping a close eye on that boy, that's what.
She set the story back in that North Carolina graveyard where she came across those slave gravestones. On stage, we get to hear about the fate of Betty, Alvis, and George.
I know you don't believe me, but I'm going to help her bring the storm. I'm going to help her deliver.
Children go where sin thee.
We actually pop in on their lives, or afterlives, as it were, multiple times. The music changes, but their circumstances never do. The trio can never seem to escape the dangers of being killed by a gun, no matter the entry point on America's history timeline. These theater artists say they know their story can't solve the issue of gun violence here in South LA, or anywhere in the country for that matter. But the goal, says Watts resident and show producer Bruce Lemon, is to make sure people know that art is another tool to help craft some possible solutions to a seemingly impossible problem.
Let's bring it to the community. Let's make it happen so it's a regular thing so that the kids around the corner can come in here and see themselves represented on stage, but nobody's gonna know that unless they have the experience.
It scared me.
For Denise Perkins, this play was personal because she had just learned news of her nephew.
I just lost a nephew tonight.
Tonight?
Tonight.
What happened?
My sister, son. I don't know if it was a drive-by, but he was shot, gunned down.
I'm so sorry about that.
I got to see her first to see what's going on. But I had to come on here, you know, because it's a bunch of ignorance. I mean, life's too short for that.
Hey, you know Roland in My Sweet Baby's Arms?
No.
Ooh, well, I ain't gonna work on the railroad.
For The Frame, I'm Marcos Najera.
Gonna work on the farm.
Rogue Machine's Gunshot Medley Part 1 runs July 6th through August 11th at the Electric Lodge in Venice, and the show features KPCC's own Millie Langford in the cast. And that is The Frame for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here on Monday from the Moen Broadcast Center. Have a great weekend. I'm rolling my sweet baby.